Welcome to the Voices of Freedom podcast by Freedom a la Carte. Each week, you'll hear mind-blowing interviews from survivors and professionals, as well as actionable tips that you can implement in your life to become a better advocate for human trafficking survivors. Thanks for spending time with us today. Now let's jump into the next episode of Voices of Freedom. Hey guys, so excited for today's episode. I know I say that every single time, but I really am excited. This episode has been a work in progress for over 3 seasons now. And it's been something that I've been really passionate about getting, finding this person, I guess, because I know how impactful and unique their story will be. And that is a male survivor story. We support women at Freedom a la Carte. That's who our main voice is that you hear on Voices of Freedom. But sex trafficking happens to men as well. And I know that this will just bring like a unique twist to our podcast and have a unique story to share with you guys. So I finally secured a male survivor guest. His name is John Michael Lander. He is the sweetest. Really, really excited to hear what you guys have to say about this episode. A quick intro to who John Michael is. So he is a former Olympic diving contender and sexual abuse survivor. As a 14-year-old Olympic-bound athlete, the adults entrusted in John Michael's training groomed and trafficked him into silence. Through writing, speaking, and consulting, he helps individuals and organizations identify the predatory grooming trifecta. He also openly talks about male trauma bonding, locker room talk, how to talk to male survivors, and the reluctancy of reporting. He is a certified trainer and life coach for the Self Talk Institute and is helping survivors find their voice. Today's episode is about grooming, and John Michael shares his lived experiences and his expertise on the topic with us. And I really, really enjoyed this episode with him, and I hope that you guys also enjoy as much as I did. So let's jump into this next episode. Okay, John Michael, can you jump in and share a few fun facts about yourself, like hobbies, pets, favorite movie?
Sure, yes. My hobbies, I enjoy boxing. I go to Taito Boxing and I take classes every day. It's one of the ways to keep my self-care going on, and it helps me ground myself. So I highly recommend it. If you've ever done it or if you've not done it, go and do it. It's really, really pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. And I also love to jog because that's like my meditation time. You know, when I'm jogging, I can listen to some self-help tapes or listen to a podcast or anything. So those are my hobbies. I have two pets, two Boston Terriers, whose names are Bear and Bandit. They're from the same litter. They're actual sisters. I know Bear and Bandit's usually male names, but that's who they are.
Yeah.
And they're inseparable, and they have to be. They're actually sitting right here next to me right now.
Aww.
All cuddled underneath a blanket. And my favorite movie, this is going to tell you so much about me, but I hope people remember it. It's it's called Somewhere in Time.
I don't know if I heard of that.
Oh my God. Christopher Reeves. And Jane Seymour. It's just one of those romantic movies, and I'm a total romantic at heart, so.
I'll have to watch that in my free time.
Yes, especially when the little one comes along.
Yeah, I'll have a lot of that, so. Okay, today's episode is about grooming, and you're going to be sharing all about that, but before we dive in, can you explain what this term grooming means in the way that we're using it?
Oh, definitely. Grooming right now, it's getting a lot of heat because a lot of people do not want to associate it with sexual abuse. But to me, what grooming is basically in the simple form is a method that a predator will use to gain trust from the survivor and to be able to get closer to that person. Mm-hmm. And I just want to remind everybody that we've all been groomed since the time we were born. when we, you know, with by our parents, by the school, by the teachers, by coaches, everyone around us, we're like these little sponges and we're just absorbing everything in. And so our society and our ethnic backgrounds and all that is what we take in. And so we kind of adapted, we adopted, we download all this information, and that's what creates who we are and how we see things and what we believe. And predators rely on this method to get close to these children. Mm-hmm. And also, they will sometimes groom the parents, which in my case is what happened, which sets up the whole predatorial grooming trifecta, where the predator will groom the institution first so that they can get the trust of the organization and to support them and to protect them, basically. And then they'll go to the parents so that they get their permission and consent to move forward. And so then the parents are, like in the Nasser case with the gymnast, Dr. Nasser was abusing the girls inside the examining room with the parents right there, with his back to the parents, just explaining, I'm doing this procedure and I'm going to have to do this, and kind of using medical terms. So the parents think this is a legit situation.
Right.
And the whole time he's abusing that child. And then they come in, they abuse the child. So, and a lot of times I just want to say that predators will also get themselves to the point that they're friends of the family. And then in my case, many of the predators were invited to the house for dinner and would sit across the table from me. And of course, they present the best of themselves. So everyone thinks they're great. So that's how I term the word grooming. And when I use it, is in that sense.
So you shared a little bit that you do have lived experience with this. Can you share a surface level view of what your experience being a survivor who has experienced grooming, what that looked like?
Sure. As a 14-year-old Olympic bound athlete, the adults that were entrusted in my training, they groomed and trafficked me into silence, causing the most exciting time of my life to be filled with shame and guilt. And at the same time, I still went on to win gold medals at the Norway and Danish Cups. So when I first took eighth at the Junior Olympics at Lincoln, Nebraska, is when everything started to happen. And there was an article that was presented in the local newspaper, and this lawyer saw it, and he contacted my mother. And so he and my mother privately started to meet over months. It was a couple, I would say almost 3 months that they met. And during this whole time, he was grooming her and showing her how his friends, this group of professionals, could help with my parents with finances for my sport. And so she got to the point that they basically told her that the only way I could go to the Olympics or even get a college scholarship was through them, because they would make sure that everything worked. And this would take the burden off my mother. And in return, every professional that is a part of this would provide the family some type of pro bono service, you know, eye exams, medicine, and all this. And at the time, my youngest sister had a sledding accident and had cut up her chin and needed plastic surgery. So everything was taken care of with no cost to my parents. But then they also told my parents that if I didn't show up at the right place at the right time and make these people happy, they would come back and my parents would have to pay everything back. And that they would take the children away. So there was a threat based on this with my mom as well. One point, it looks like it's going to be a great thing. It's going to help everybody. And on the other side, if it doesn't happen, I'm responsible for all this.
Right.
And so that's how it all worked out. And that's how it started. And it wasn't until my mother basically gave consent did I ever meet the lawyer and the other professionals. So it was that kind of a situation set up.
So what did they tell your parents that you would be doing, like, how you would fulfill your end of the deal?
Well, they told my mother, basically, because my father stayed out of it mostly. They told my mother that these professionals have been following me for a while and have seen how quickly I've been rising in the sport, and they wanted to help. And so all they wanted to do was have dinner or maybe go see a play or go to a show, go to a party or something. And all I had to do was just go and enjoy sitting there talking to them, and that they were going to ask me questions so that they could see if they could help me. So it was constantly like being interviewed all the time. So in my mom's mind, I'm sure she thought, oh, these are people who want to help. They just want to get to know you a little bit better So just go and have a good time and answer their questions. Hmm. Be polite. That was always what she told me to be.
Okay. So can you talk about what was said to you to normalize what was being done by your mom and these other people?
Sure. Well, basically a little bit of what I just said was kind of how it normalized itself a lot, was the fact that with my mother talking to me, all I had to do was go to have dinner with these people. They just wanted to spend some time with me to get to know me. They wanted to see how they could help me. It was all about this possibility. And even though some of the professionals were repeated, and I'd already done this with them before, that's when I started to wondering what is more here, because what else can I tell them? They know everything. They questioned everything the first time. And so my mother basically, when I asked my mother that, she basically said, they just want to have a good friend. They want to be your friend, and they're helping the family and they're helping themselves. This is just part of your job that you have to do. And so I just thought, okay. And then the professional, especially the lawyer, was telling me that this was what was needed to be the best that I could be. If I wanted to go to the Olympics, I needed to follow these steps. And that they didn't want to look at any other athlete. I was the only one that they wanted to work with. They wanted to make sure that I got all the way to the Olympic Games. And so there was this privilege feeling, this constant about how good I was. And they would tell me things, you know, that my parents wouldn't say to me, you know, you're doing really great in school. It was all about this friendship, this bonding that they were creating. Even though they were much older than I was, I found myself following into that pattern, you know, until it got to the point later on when I started getting older that I started to realize, because this went over all four of my high school years.
Okay.
And then the coach on his side was more about telling me that this is the way it works. This is how, you know, each sport has their own jargon. Well, and by that environment, there are certain rules and jargon and the way people talk and coach that are normal. And touching our bodies was a normal thing in the sport that I was in, such as diving, which is also in gymnastics, but I've seen it in all sports. And so he would start touching me in public, you know, and he would lean in and he'd put his hand on the small of my back when he would give me instructions. And then the touches lingered and they would move to my chest or my leg. But he did this all in front of everyone. You know, if we were at a competition, he did it. If we were at practice, it was in front of everybody. So it came across as being normal. And he would constantly say, this is how I coach. This is the way that I can teach you where your body position should be in the air. So this is just, and so I took it as normal. This is the way it is. And he always kept in mind, kept reminding me that there was always five other athletes behind me that would love to be in the position I'm in. And if I didn't like this, one of those guys could come and take my place.
Kind of like scary.
And always, right. And I'm in this privileged position. And he's this well-known coach. Everyone likes him. What an honor it was for me to be there. So that's how it all got normalized.
Did you ever see them doing what they were doing with you, like with other athletes?
Yes, to a certain extent. You know, was the coach handsy with the other athletes? Yes. Hand always on someone's shoulder, always on their lower back, especially when he was talking or giving instructions. Now, things seemed to linger a little longer with me. And I think that was his way of testing the boundaries to see how far he could go. Where could this go? And I believe that predators are always constantly testing those boundaries with the survivors. And since I was the one that he had selected, that was his way of doing it.
Did you ever like talk amongst any of your other like co-athletes or teammates or whatever and be like, hey, this is like what I did last night? Is this like what you are also doing? Or?
Well, I think that's a great question. And it's really interesting because when the coach started taking me to overnight trips to the university to practice with the university team, because he felt that that was a challenge to me. He felt that I had already surpassed my teammates and he wanted to put me in a situation that would push me. And so they also at the same time, the professionals had made sure that I had one doctor that became my doctor. And that was one of the doctors that was part of the professional group. And so I would have to see him, and his nickname, you know, he had various nicknames, but he was also the head doctor for all the varsity coaches at the university. And so he was seeing like 14 different, you know, teams come through, and the teams had, the athletes had to get cleared by him so that they could compete that week. Okay. So yeah, I would talk with them a little bit about it. And they said, oh yeah, that's so normal. That's what he does to all of us. You go in for an ear infection and he's touching your other places, you know, just to see and say, oh, that's just where all the infection falls and stuff like that. And so they would joke about it. Mm-hmm. And we'd even talk to some of the coaches, and the coaches knew. So we all thought, well, if everybody knows, then this must be the normal thing. This is just what it is. And they laughed about it, and they kind of just said, just don't take it seriously. He's, you know, he's just Dr. Hansy, and let him go and just get through it. Just get in there as quickly as you can and get out as quick as you can.
So when did all of this hit you that you're like, okay, this actually is not normal and I'm not okay with this?
Excellent question. It was after I had won the Norway and the Danish Cups. It was that whole tour. And I was away from these people for a while because I was in Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Canada, and Mexico. And so when I came home is when I started to realize this is not normal. This doesn't seem right. Although I had had that feeling late earlier on when things started to happen. Mm-hmm. But I got to the point where I started to act things out or send out indicators. I wanted people to find out what was happening. Although I promised that I would never say anything because then that would ruin everything. And I remember one time my mother had set me up and was waiting at the door for me to leave, and I wouldn't go. I said, I'm not doing this. This is it. This is where I'm stopping it. So this was about this when I was 16. So everything started when I was 14. So by 16, I said no more. Mm-hmm. And I told her I wasn't going. And she looked at me and she said, why? And I told her that they touched me. They touched me. And she says, where? And I kind of indicated. And then she looked at me really funny. And then she got this strange look on her face and said, you know, it's not nice to make up lies about people. He is a prominent person in the community. Everyone likes him. Wow. And if anything ever happened, it must have been your fault. And then she slapped me.
Oh, gosh.
And then she said, you're going out and you're going to have dinner with this person. And then you're going to come back and tell me everything that you had for dinner. And this is going to be a great evening for you.
Aww.
Go. So right then, I believed that if I couldn't, you know, my mother wasn't going to believe me, who would believe me?
Right.
But then I started doing things like, you know, indicators, because if I could create some kind of interest of someone asking me what was wrong, then I could tell them. Instead of me going to someone and saying something happened, this was a way that I could get them to ask me. Then it was okay because I couldn't help. I had to tell them is right. how I kind of made it work out. But nobody did. Every indicator that I had done, no one asked me what was wrong or what was going on.
Aww.
So then I started to try to find ways of how can I regain my control in these situations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started to try different things. And sometimes they worked and sometimes they didn't. One of the things that I did is I started to act like I liked that person. I thought that they were attractive and I would tell them. And I realized that these professionals had children my age. And by coming onto them at that point, turn the tables a little bit, and one of two things would happen. The event would have been over and I would have been dropped off at home, or it became very violent because they did not want to see that aspect. And they wanted to make sure they got what they wanted when they came. Hmm. And either way, it was quicker. And so that was one of the other things. And the other way I figured out that would work is if I did not climax, then I was in control. And then in my head that this was not sex. So if we can get them to take care of everything and get it over with, we were done. We can go home.
Right.
So it became about how quickly could I get everything finished?
Yeah. You figured out these survival tactics for yourself to basically survive.
Right. But those were the ones that were outside of myself. I also had things that were going on inside. And I'm sure you probably understand this too. The detachments. The ability to detach myself from the moment of what's going on there and separate myself.
Mm-hmm.
Denial. I constantly was in denial, especially when my mother showed me that I couldn't trust, or she couldn't trust me and I couldn't get help from her. I started to find ways to compartmentalize things. Thought of myself like, this is the good boy. This is the athlete. This, you know, everything had its own little place.
Yes.
And I was able to separate them for a time that I was going through high school.
I just spoke with another survivor leader in the community, and she said very similar things of where she basically lived a double life. And that's how she was able to survive that period of her life. So I'm sure it's very common.
It's very stressful too, because I had to be a certain person during the events. Mm-hmm. And then I'd have to be somebody different when I was going to school with my friends. And there was always the fear that I thought that my friends knew what was going on. Mm-hmm. And then if they ever really found out, that they would never be my friend again. And I really needed those friendships, because that was the only connection that I had at the time besides the coach. And at that point is where we can talk about male trauma bonding, because I bonded so close with the coach, because he told me he knew what was going on and he was there to help me. And that's how that grew. Mm. So I had it was crazy. I think it became really like, it was hard to decide who I was with all these different personalities happening.
I can't, and then add on the fact that you're a child at that time. So your brain isn't even fully developed. You can't even comprehend what is fully going on because you're a child. And so, you know, I mean, I'm sure it's difficult as an adult too, but I just think adding in the fact that you were a child is just even more complex to the situation.
You're absolutely right. And I think the biggest thing for me was my first experience was with a 60-year-old doctor, you know, and that was my introduction to sex. And I didn't like it. Although my body responded, I didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. It created so much confusion within my head, because at that time, my 14-year-old brain was not able to wrap around what this meant. What is this? And I was one of those late developers. So I was not even interested in sex yet. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is not what I want to talk about. I would just get embarrassed if anyone did speak about it. So to have it thrust upon me, I didn't know what that meant. And then I started questioning like all different things. What did this mean? Does this mean that my sexual orientation is this now? Mm-hmm. Did I even get the chance to figure it out with someone my age? Mm-hmm. You know, and can I ever go back and figure it out with people my age? Or am I always going to be this spoiled person? Do you know what I mean? I remember my father would always use Bible verses, and I really believed that he knew what was going on, but he would say things like, you know, to lie with a man is an abomination. You must be an abomination. And I didn't know what that meant, because I was doing what they told me to do. So how am I an abomination? So things like that were confusing.
Yeah.
I know I wanted to go to the prom with one of the girls at school. And I went as far as take flowers to where she worked. And she said no. So in my head, I thought that she had figured it out.
Hmm.
And so it was all fear. 4 years of high school was based on fear that someone would find out, and also the fear of hoping somebody would find out. So you had both sides going on.
Yeah. Wow.
And it's just exhausting.
Yeah. That sounds like a lot of like trauma stacked on trauma.
And yeah, we didn't know at the time, or I didn't know at the time, that it was trauma. You know, I wasn't able to identify that's what that was.
Right.
And so I just thought that I was cracking up. I thought I was losing my mind.
Oh. I appreciate you sharing those vulnerable memories with us and going back in that time, because I can only imagine it's not easy. So I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you for asking and setting up a safe space for me to share that.
Stepping outside of your experience and more stepping into like your expertise, are there warning signs that people should be aware of?
Yes, yes. I just want to make sure that everyone understands that each predator has their own unique way of pursuing a child. Mm-hmm. And I just think we're talking about children and teenagers at this point. So, and there is not one like checkoff list that shows that this is what happened. So we need to make sure that that is clear for everybody.
Yes, thank you.
Because I know our society wants a checkoff list. You know, we can say, well, he had check off one, but didn't check off two, check off five. We must not have a problem here.
Right.
And yet you do have a problem. So I just want to make sure that's out there. The things that I tell parents to really look out for is to be aware how the person interacts with children. If it's a sports situation, if it's a cheerleading group, if it's a dance class, if it's even in class, you can find out, you know, things. And just to be aware, how is that person interacting with children? Because whenever there is a power position, there's always the possibility of some type of an abuse. Mm-hmm. It could be a verbal abuse. It could be whatever. It's still all abuse. And I think if you really can interact with that, you can see it. I remember I was coaching a diving team, and the swimming team was practicing at the same time. And the other head coach and I would look at each other and watch the coach of the swimming team and say, wait a second, that's a little too friendly with that young girl.
Hmm.
What's going on? And then having the gumption, I guess you would say, to go and ask, you know, and I think parents need to ask those hard questions. That's what we can get into proactive for parents.
Yeah.
But parents need to watch out and see what's happening in the interaction. If there's something kind of weird, follow your instincts on that. Also, look at if the child's behavior has changed. Indicators. There are many different things. I know in my case, I was immaculate as a kid. I could not have a speck of dirt or dust on my clothes, or I'd go change.
Mm.
And once all the abuse started happening, I'd wear the same outfit for the whole week.
Oh, wow.
And nobody asked. I stopped showering. I was a kid that would shower 3 times a day. And I just stopped showering. So I'd wear dirty clothes and not shower. And my parents never asked, never said anything. And the thing that was really crazy is that the teachers at school didn't ask anything either, because they were seeing me every day coming in the same outfit.
Did your siblings,
yes.
You mentioned you had a sister. I don't know if you have any more siblings, but did your siblings ever like recognize anything? Really?
I think my youngest sister did, but she was only 8 at the time. So I don't think she was able to formulate what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
I remember saying, she said, you're different. What's wrong? She did ask, but I couldn't tell an 8-year-old.
Right. Yeah.
So I because I thought I was protecting her.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, I was 1 of 6, but my parents had foster children coming in out of the house all the time. So there was a constant change all the time. And it was sometimes I think my parents thought, oh, he must not be getting along with one of the foster kids. And so there's always excuses made.
Mm-hmm.
And the showering situation, my mother would say, well, he's in the pool in the morning and in the afternoon, so he must not think he needs it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think the biggest thing that was a change for me is I was one of those kids that couldn't cuss or say a bad word because everybody would laugh at me because it just didn't fit. And so I started dropping the F-bomb as loud as I could.
Mm-hmm.
And still no one asked me.
You were just like screaming for attention.
I was screaming for help.
Yeah, for help. Yeah. So you led into the next question, which is, how can we be proactive about grooming for our children?
I think the first thing, parents need to follow their instincts. I do think that, especially mothers, have that sixth instinct about them, that they just know something's wrong. They may not know exactly what it is, but they know something is just not right. And to follow that and to ask questions, open-ended questions, and find out if there's defensiveness going on. Is there something very different? Because I think a mother, if she's, you know, with the family enough, knows the difference with her children. And unless the mother is, say, abused herself, mm-hmm. or is, you know, addicted to drugs or something like that. We're right. talking about a normal functioning family, which is where I came from. And so my mother should have known those things and should have asked. And later in life, I've talked to her about that. And she said, yeah, I had an instinct, but I didn't know what to say. And then she said, I was more worried about what people would think of me than to find out what was really going on. Because if I could turn my face away from it, it was not real.
Hmm.
But if I heard it, then I knew that it had to be something serious. And so she kept pushing it away, even though she was the one preparing me to get ready and be at the right place at the right time. And she had this agreement with the lawyer. It just became a really hard situation. So I think parents need to follow those instincts. I think parents also need to ask those tough questions. If it's not with the child, you know, go to the teacher, go to the coach, ask, why are you here? What was your last coaching position? And why did you leave there? go to the HR program people and ask them, what did you use to get, you know, this person here? And did you do a background check? What was the background check? And asking these questions. And unfortunately, a lot of parents won't do that because then they're considered helicopter parents.
Right.
And they don't want to do that. They don't want people to think that. But this is your child we're talking about.
Yeah.
This is their lives. And in an abusive situation, the rest of their life, they're going to try to have to go through a journey of healing. It doesn't just, you don't heal overnight. This is a lifelong process we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the other thing, is to ask those questions. Also to listen to your children. Really listen with your eyes and your ears and your instinct. Because your child, I truly believe every child wants someone to know that something's not right.
Mm-hmm.
That something bad has happened. That Uncle George touched me in a weird way.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know how to say it. We're not sure how to put it in words sometimes. We're afraid. What will mom think? That's her brother. You know, all these kind of things. But if you start asking and watching the child's behavior, you will see that something has happened. And I just remember talking with my mother. We did an interview around Thanksgiving. And she told the interviewer, she says, I knew something was wrong because he had withdrew. He was such a life, the party out, happy. And all of a sudden he was in his room by himself all the time. He wasn't happy anymore. He stayed by himself, isolated himself. Although all of my, I guess you would say predators isolated me. So that's what I knew. And I was so full of shame and guilt that I didn't know what to say to anyone. And I think that if she would have extended a hand to me at that point, I would have told her everything.
Yeah. Well, you know? You tried.
And just look out for those indicators because they're letting you know.
Yeah. Thank you so much for diving into this conversation with us and sharing your experience and your expertise with us, what grooming is. I think, you know, this is a conversation that could be talked about for hours. But I think this is a good, like, first step of raising awareness and education around it. I want to remind the listeners to share their voice because their voice matters.